to another Night at the Round Table. My name is Derek Hayes. Tonight, we are joined by a guest, but first, gentlemen, introduce yourselves.
Hey, I'm David Flora from the Blurry Photos Podcast.
And I'm Justin Zinger from the Zingness Podcast.
And she is a doctor of philosophy and literature, as well as the writer and host of Monstrum on PBS. Please welcome our very first guest to the round table, Dr. Emily Zarka. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for coming aboard. I'm pretty excited to have you here because I've been a fan of your show for at least a year now. And some of the stuff you cover, I can't find anywhere else. So I just kind of eat it up.
Oh, thank you so much. That makes my heart sing. I'm happy that you're watching. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the show and about yourself some?
Absolutely. So the show is called Monstrum. It airs on PBS's YouTube channel Storied. And essentially, I approach human history as monster history. So using monsters and their background as a way to talk about more complex topics than maybe you would expect. Because I found that people are more willing to get into like some of the nitty gritty stuff if I portray it as something spooky and strange first.
Very cool.
And you're not only covering cryptids, you're covering mythology. It's like a wide swath of monsters, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So each episode focuses on one particular monster, and I trace its roots through time and place to try to figure out not only why that particular creature looks and acts the way it does, but why people felt the need to invent it in the first place. So I end up, diving into things like science and politics and art and mythology in addition to the monster itself.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. So in the show, what kind of monsters you end up covering? What are some examples of some of your favorites?
Some of my favorites, that's a hard one. So we cover pretty much everything from around the globe. We try to do our best to make sure we're portraying monsters from all over the world in different time periods. But some of my favorites so far have been the flesh-eating Wendigo monster of Algonquian folklore. I also really enjoyed the Filipino Mononongal, who doesn't love a disembodied, woman with bat wings flying around. And excitingly, we actually are finally tackling zombies, which are a subject very near and dear to my heart.
Well, it just so happens. David, what are we watching this week?
Well, this week we have picked The Serpent and the Rainbow, which is a classic. I guess you can consider it classic now, but it's probably, jumping the gun a little bit, one of the better zombie movies out there because it really draws from actual lore, especially the Haitian voodoo, and it also portrays the stuff without being over the top like Night of the Living Dead. And we thought it'd be great to talk to Dr. Zarka about this because Dr. Zarka, you are featuring zombies this month. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So we have a three-part series running on Monstrum on our YouTube channel right now, separating the zombies into Haitian voodoo zombies, Romero zombies, and what I'm calling pandemic zombies. And all of that leads up to Exhumed, A History of Zombies, which will premiere Friday, October 30th on PBS.
In fact, we have a trailer. Let's cut to that right now.
When you hear zombie, do you think of shambling, flesh-eating corpses? Or maybe violent, infected humans?
I'm Dr. Emily Zarka, and I'm a monster expert.
Americana is steeped in zombie lore.
We clearly had an appetite for these kinds of stories.
By diving into the historical creatures we fear, we can learn a lot about ourselves.
Exhumed, A History of Zombies, Friday, October 30th, only on PBS.
I can't wait to watch that. I saw the first one so far, and it's pretty good. Pretty good stuff.
Thank you so much. It's a labor of love, and a lot of people were integral in the process. So I get the chance to tell the story.
It looks like there's a lot going into it. Storytelling.
The visuals are amazing.
Visuals. Yeah. It's really an experience.
Yeah, thank you.
So, gentlemen and ma'am, I'm sure ma'am is not the correct.
Ma'am's fine.
Somebody that's much younger than I am. We watched this film. What were you guys' initial thoughts on this? What stuck out to you that besides the obvious scene. There was probably an obvious scene that stuck out to a handful of us, but we'll get to that here in a little bit. As an overall, what did this movie say to you? And Dr. Z, we'll start with you as our guest.
This might be a controversial opinion, but I don't think it did a great job of showing Haitian voodoo accurately, at least from what I understand. But I will say that I came into it with probably a little bit of a biased perspective, since some of the voodoo and voodoo practitioners I actually talked to all said that they didn't feel it was an accurate representation. So I think that was already in my mind a little bit, but it's definitely unique for a zombie movie.
Well, it's hard to believe a Wes Craven movie from 1988 wouldn't depict something accurately, but I feel like this movie was fueled by money and probably cocaine.
There was a lot more
1988,
but a lot more than zombie dust they were blowing around.
Fueled by good intentions, but
some intentions anyway.
Some intentions, yeah.
I'll just jump in real quick. I thought it was enjoyable. I remember watching this as a kid. I was probably maybe 10 or something when I watched this. I shouldn't have watched this when I was 10, but I did. I watched all kinds of stuff when I was 10 that I shouldn't have. But it kind of held up for me. It scared me when I was a kid. It terrified me. Snakes jumping out of skeletons, that sort of thing. Just the idea of zombies. And anytime you put that label based on a true story on any film like this, that just adds an element of nightmare that you can't calculate. So when I rewatched it, I kind of laughed at myself a little bit because of the stuff that I was afraid of. But at the same time, I could understand why I had those feelings. There were some jump scares and some spooky imagery in this that really, kind of lasts throughout the decades. Justin and Zinger, what did you guys think?
Oh, wow. I'm two people now. Cool.
Sorry, David and Zinger. It's been a long year.
It has been a long year. So when you originally messaged us with this, my reaction, I think I actually put it in the text, was I thought this was like something about like Norse mythology or something. So I was like, oh, Serpent and the Rainbow, Bifrost and Jormungandr. Oh, and then it's like, no, it's really not. So I had no clue going into this. I mentioned it to my co-host and lovely fiance Ellie that I was going to be watching this, and she just laughed and went, okay, have a fun time. I'm like, have you seen it? She goes, years ago, you'll enjoy it. I watched this. I was very confused for a lot of it because I just don't understand how Bill Pullman went from his all-star role as the lead in Spaceballs to following it up with this. I was very confused what Lone Star was doing in this movie. And
if you think you're confused, try being 10 years old and having this
experience. I agree, but I think we missed out on a great opportunity from Bill Pullman for just being he's a good screamer in this movie, because I think that's most of his lines of dialogue is just him screaming in response to stuff. I had no clue going into this what I was getting into. I watched it. I had no clue what I had just watched. And then I informed myself by, one, watching the origin of zombies from Haiti on Monstrum, and also informing myself by listening to an episode 48 of a podcast called Blurry Photos to help inform my opinion of this. And I do agree that from what your video said, Dr. Z, and what Blurry Photos, David, said years ago now, this is not a good depiction of it's a depiction of the pop culture of Haitian zombies, not the actual voodoo or voodoo. And I'm sorry, I'm going to mix those up and I'm going to look like an idiot. So I'm just going to say them quick and then move on to David.
Yeah. I had always heard about this movie and never come across it until I started doing the podcast. And we did that episode a while back, but I didn't watch it then. So I was glad to have the opportunity to watch it now. And I thought and this is where I am going to come back and say what I said before. Comparatively to all the other zombie movies out there, I feel like this at least gives you some idea of what the actual culture has in terms of the rites and stuff. Now, there aren't any spooky spirits that are flying out of jars when you bust them open. I've, yet to see that in real life. But in terms of between this and like we were saying, the Romero zombies and things like that, Walking Dead even, I feel like you're not going to learn the correct folklore from this, but it's going to be better than just a disease that takes over people and then everybody climbs up walls and eats each other. that's my re-caveat. But I thought it was pretty well done. I like Wes Craven movies in general. I think he knows, you know, what he's doing with stuff. Now, it could have been a little better, and we're probably going to get into that a little bit, but I think that the effects were pretty great in it. I was surprised with how kind of it kept me engaged. And I didn't say this before. It's from 1988. So, you know, stuff that's dated, it didn't bother me that much for it. And I thought Bill Pullman did a good job in it. And so going into it, I didn't expect a lot. And I think that this exceeded those expectations, which isn't saying a lot. But I didn't really summarize it, though. Bill Pullman is an anthropologist who goes to Haiti he was trying to find this toxin, this powder that they had heard, this medical company, I think it was, had heard could put someone in a trance, in a almost like death trance, right? And they were trying to find something that's better than anesthesia for patients in America who were dying, you know, of anesthetic reactions while they were having surgeries and things. So that's the whole premise. He goes down there to kind of find this, and then he gets in all sorts of trouble and adventures and stuff, and then comes home with it, and then goes back.
For the woman. It's always for the woman.
Of course.
For the woman, yeah. I jotted down the note that this thing could be titled Serpent in the Rainbow, a.k.a. Zombie for Love. So... So it wasn't bad. I'm excited to get your all's takes on it.
This is a good time to piggyback, and Dr. Z, I'm hoping you can help us out with this. This is based on a true story, I'm sure loosely, and I'm somewhat familiar with the story of, I can't say his name, Clairvius Narcisse, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about it before we started recording. Mm-hmm. So basically, do you want to tell that story? Do you mind? Do you know it well enough? Or
I don't know if I know what's too much about, but I can give a little bit of background about. So yes, it is based on a book written by Wade Davis, who was a Harvard anthropologist and botanist, I believe, who, yes, did go to Haiti, not at the behest of any pharmaceutical company, but to attempt to figure out what was being used to put people in this zombie state and essentially to prove if zombies were real or not. So that's kind of where the book came from. I actually was just reading in an interview. He hated the idea that actually the book would be turned into a movie, and a horror movie, no less. But he said the money was too good to pass up. So he kind of went along with it, which I find interesting. But yeah, the first, what they're referring to is the case of a documented zombie in Haiti. And I think it's worth pointing out that for a lot of Haitians, historically and even now, zombies and just Vodou and Voodoo practitioners, zombies are a very real thing. So I think it's an interesting line to toe. But yeah, I don't know too much about the story of that first one that much. But I think, again, what I do know is that that man was 100% believed to be a zombie.
Yeah. I can piggyback a bit on it. Or David, do you know, I know maybe you did an episode on it a while back.
It's a lot like what's in the film in a lot of ways, where there was a guy who was said to have died and they buried him. And then years later, they see him working on a plantation, basically. And it was the same guy. And the story was that a, you know, practitioner blew some powder in his face and made him seem like he was dead, raised him from the dead, and then had him work for him. And I think that's basically what the Davis book and this subsequently film was based on.
Now, in my research that I did, which was maybe an hour of reading, I read that his brother was actually suspected to be the one that actually zombified him. I don't know if that's the correct term. because he wouldn't share land that was left from his parents or something along those lines. And it almost seemed like they used this zombie state of mind as a political tool. Is that something that's taking place down there, or is this just a folklore kind of situation? Yeah. I don't open a can of worms or anything, but it just seems like this is more of a tool for massaging culture rather than just simply, you know, acquiring slaves or something along those lines.
I think that the idea that zombification in Haiti is a political tool is sort of a false narrative that's been sold to us as white Westerners, essentially, to try to make Haiti seem more demonized. I mean, don't get me wrong. Haiti has had problems and continues to have them like any other country in the world. But I think this, you know, sort of idea that like, oh, all these political leaders are pulling the strings of these, you know, voodoo priests and priestesses and making their political prisoners into zombies is ridiculous. And I haven't found any evidence that would support that. But that being said, I do think that from my understanding of Haitian voodoo and voodoo is zombification is a means of control, essentially. So it's both a threat and also like a promise. And it's a way to get people who maybe aren't in fully control of themselves, like into a state where they can be safe. It's safe for them and for the people around them.
Okay. Because, you know, in the film, there's the bee story where there's like political turmoil going on in Haiti. And I don't know what the guy's position was. I could probably check real quick. But he was trying to get Bill Pullman's character out of the country for espionage reasons and all these other things. So there's a lot going on there. And it certainly seemed political in the film. And then, you know, obviously I read that about our friend Claire Vias, I guess. Mm-hmm. Fun stuff. Fun stuff. So what can you tell us about, you said that what you see in the film isn't necessarily a good representation. What do you see there that's different, or what stuck out to you that you're like, oh, this is way off. They would never do this.
Well, I've had the privilege of going into both a voodoo priest church and religious space and then a voodoo priestesses temple. And one thing that always stands out to me, especially in this movie, is everything is like super dark and there's like very dramatic, and it's shot in this way where you're supposed to be getting jump scares from some of the like religious items that they're using, which is like something doves. That I feel like, which is something I always try to ask myself. It's like, okay, how would I feel if Catholicism or Judaism was being portrayed this way? And if I'm like, it seems a little off, then I'm like, there's something going on here. And that's what I felt about the movie. I know I took a note at one part at the end when they're, you know, fighting for Bill Pullman's soul, that there's just like a random pile of skulls in this religious space.
That catches on fire, by the way.
Yeah, they're flammable.
He's got all those zombies working for him and none of them clean up. Like,
apparently
not one of them.
And just this idea that I think they reiterated this idea that voodoo is all about like death, and it's like a very death-centric culture, where the exact opposite, I feel like it's true. And again, from what I understand about how ancestors and the past are so important to voodoo and voodoo, that the idea of them having a pile of skulls, I think would be incredibly disrespectful for the religion. So I think anytime a religion is shot like a horror movie, I'm always like raising an eyebrow, like, oh, okay, we're doing this.
I've got to talk about this scene real quick, because there are two moments in this movie that made my skin crawl to no end. The first one was the needle in the eye, like under the eye. I can't do eye stuff. Like, I can't. So seeing that, like, I instantly was like, ah. And that's like within the first, like, 2 minutes of the movie. So I was like, oh, I really hope this is the worst this is gonna get with that.
For those that for those that refuse to watch it, at the beginning you see this gentleman that's deceased,
quote unquote,
presumably deceased, on the table, and they're doing all these tests to see if he's dead. They put the mirror up to his mouth to see if it fogs up, and finally they put a needle under the skin under his eye and he doesn't move. And even as a kid, that terrified me. Like,
Which I'm a PhD, not an MD, but I'm pretty sure that's not what you do to test if someone's alive or not.
It would probably work, right? I know it wouldn't work.
I'd hate to have that happen and then shoot up. Oh, also, I guess the third thing that kind of terrified me was the whole vision like from the body sitting there. Like, I'm like, yeah. That would terrify me to be like sitting there in a undead state. Sorry, I'm using big quotation fingers and being like, I'm able to see, I'm able to hear, but I'm not able to interact, yeah. Especially when you're sitting there in a moment where it's like, oh, he's dead. And it's like, I'm yeah. not. The other thing, this, and the whole zombification thing within the premise of the movie, I'm going within the premise and the rules of the movie, is the zombie powder blown in the face. And I'm not trying to date this. I'm not trying to bring up anything, but right now, if someone coughs within a 20-foot radius of me, I like instantly like start to be like, what? So I couldn't imagine in this day and age having someone walk up and blow a thing of powder in my face. Like if I just happened to not have a mask on for that split second and be like, what happened? What? Sorry for the audio there, but yeah, I'd be coughing up chunks and stuff. I don't know. It's just that those scenes just made me just everything else, the zombie stuff, the snakes, the scorpion. I was like, ah, whatever. But those scenes, I was like, ah.
Well, you know, I thought you were going to talk about a completely different scene. Really? I'll be honest.
you're going to say something. Really. I'm going to be like, that was whatever. I don't care.
There's a couple of memorable ones here.
How do I even? I'll just try this. So there's a scene where Bill Pullman is stopped by this Gestapo. I don't know what this guy is. He's in charge.
Tells
him he needs to leave. You know, get out of our country, kind of situation. And of course, he doesn't listen. And you know, a day later, 2 days later, he's caught again. And we see him strapped to this chair. This chair comes up again later. David's gonna have some fun with that. But he's strapped to this chair naked. And certain parts of his body are exposed. And as a form of punishment and intimidation, this gentleman uses a nail and hammer and nails down a certain part of the body that he probably didn't want nailed down. Now, it wasn't the part I thought it was as a kid. I'll be honest with you. Because I didn't know what the word scrotum meant, apparently, when I was a kid, because I thought this was a different part. But this was jarring. Even I'm 40 years old. I watched that 30 years ago. It was jarring then. It's jarring now.
I guess it was disagree? Unclear when I was watching it, like what exactly they were hammering. And then later on, he said he was like intact but hurt. So I was like, oh, okay, he's fine. Whatever.
Well, he did hobble an awful lot. I don't.
Dude, I hobble from sitting too long in a chair.
I guess that's true. That's
you got to remember
been in that situation.
His character's like fresh faced 20-year-old at this point. He can take a lot more. All us 40-year-olds sitting around here being like, oh, I hobble for nothing. Yeah, I don't need my scrotum to be nailed to hobble.
No, okay, yes. I forgot about that scene, Derek. My bad. My apologies.
Well, we had to touch on it. It had to be brought up. We
figured one of the other gentlemen would have brought that up at some point.
Well, I thought to switch gears here because everybody's needing it.
Please. Please.
I thought that... It was interesting when Bill Pullman was introduced, he was in the Amazon and he, I'm pretty sure, was doing ayahuasca, right? So, and then he goes through this hallucinatory trip where they had a really great bit where he's like wrestling with this tiny jaguar and then the medicine man, it shows him looking at him and Bill Pullman's just rolling around on the ground by himself. That was a great bit.
Like I said, there were moments in this movie that I'm like, I feel like these are from a different movie. Like, I don't understand what's going on now. Yeah, it just says that he went to the rainforest to study rare herbs and medicine from local shaman, which, I don't know. That kind of threw this whole weird turn on the movie to where, like, was this all still part of the hallucinations he had when he was in the Amazon? Is this some, because the one guy popped up in those hallucinations before he even met him. So I'm like, is this one of those psychedelic trip movies that I'm just not drinking enough or not in the right amount of stuff to understand? Like that was the other thing that caught me with this movie is, once again, I had no clue what I was getting into. And then once I got into it, I'm like, well, I'm too far into this to turn back. Better go forward.
I think that's one of the problems I have also with the film. With the film is that it's like equating these different spiritual practices like all together. Like, you're right. He does a drug in one completely different place in the world. and has some meets his jaguar spirit guide and has prophetic visions. And then all of a sudden he can still do that in Haiti. Yeah. I don't know. It just seems.
I kind of took something else from that. It was more that this ceremony kind of opened him up. And that's what allowed him to experience a lot of what he did in Haiti. Otherwise, why would they show that? It wasn't really character building, I wouldn't think, because he doesn't do ayahuasca throughout the entire film or wrestle with jaguars. None of this stuff is really brought up again, other than that terrible hologram of a jaguar at that one point. But it's like his eyes were opened by doing that ceremony at the beginning of the film. And that's kind of, he just kind of tumbles into everything else once you find yourself in that paranormal groove, so to speak, in the film. You just kind of go with the flow.
Well, Derek, if I may, they need to establish him as the go-get-it-done anthropologist, much like Indiana Jones. So they have to show him, because in every Indiana Jones movie, what do you have? You have him doing something at the beginning of the movie that is like, oh, he's so cool. So we have to show the anthropologist doing the same thing and being like, oh, he's so cool.
That's true. That's true.
It
works.
Yeah, I agree. I think they just wanted to be like, ooh, look, he's cool. He'll do drugs. Like, he'll traipse around with these, like, locals. And
play with the jaguar.
Stupid for an animal. Yeah.
And he'll drink anything you give him, too. That's
right. He didn't even question it.
Yeah. God.
Down the hatch.
Oh, boy. The technical aspects of the film, let's touch on that real quick before we move on. I thought the effects were good. They were all mostly practical. There were some pretty terrible CGI in there. Pre-computer CGI. But the practical effects were pretty good. There's some snake work that at one point, I think it was a glove that kind of grabs him in the face, but it's a snake glove.
Oh, are you talking about the classic snake from a corpse mouth trick?
Yeah.
Falls for that every time.
But yeah, I mean, it's Wes Craven, so you know you're going to be entertained for a horror film. I would love to see this remade as a serious film, you know, not a drama necessarily, but some sort of psychological thriller. Jordan Peele, are you listening?
Good call.
Yeah, right. I would say I want to see it remade by someone of Haitian descent who actually knows about the religions. That would be awesome. Yeah,
agreed.
I should point out that most of this film was actually shot in Haiti on location, which is pretty rare from what I was able to read. I can't think of a single other production that was brave enough to go shoot there. Maybe it wasn't as bad. I don't want to say it's bad, but
No, I think that they were actually told that they couldn't guarantee their safety and they had to move to the Dominican Republic.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I mean, this was a time when it was being filmed where a lot of the political issues I think the film is trying to touch on were like happening. I mean, there was political unrest, so I don't think it was the safest place.
During the production in Haiti, the local government informed the cast and crew that they could not guarantee the safety for the remainder of the film's shooting due to the shifting political strife and civil turmoil. So they relocated to the Dominican Republic and returned to shooting. Wikipedia.
Well,
thank you.
Actually, no, I just knew that off the top of my head.
Sure.
Thanks, Wolf.
Yeah, you just knew it after Dr. Zarka said it.
I was confirming it.
But still, they did some shooting in Haiti, and that's a big deal.
For me,
anyway. I liked the practical stuff. I thought the hand in the soup was a nice touch.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Well done.
Yeah. Very Beetlejuice, which came out the same year, by the way. The stairs that he was dangling off of, also very Beetlejuice. The snake, use of the snakes. So maybe it was the same. I should look into that. Maybe it was the same people. But they were both released in 1988. So
interesting.
Okay.
I had a hard time sometimes differentiating between what he was hallucinating or dreaming and what was actually happening.
Yeah, that's the other thing that got me with this. Because the one woman freaking out at the dinner who like comes at him with a knife. Yeah. And I'm like, did that happen? Is that something to where someone is possessing somebody to make him? Like, I'm like, I don't get it. Like, he got out of hate. Why are they trying to pull him back there?
Well, I think it was that government leader that's also a practitioner of some sort was controlling her. I think that actually happened, in my opinion. I didn't write that film, obviously.
Yeah.
I think this was, it was supposed to be like he was possessing her, which, again, I don't.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
So, is there anything else we need to touch on the film side, guys, before we open it up to zombies in general?
I
tell you, I liked that squeaky chair that chased him out of the room. And I love how he like looked back and it was like, get out of here, and then slammed the door. and then it like he holds a grudge against this chair at the end. He's like, hang on, I need to bust this chair up before we go. And then the chair's like, no, I'm going
to
help you.
He was setting on when he was nailed to the right. chair.
Yes.
Right. So him and this chair had history, apparently.
I think my favorite part, though, to follow that up was when the dude tore his own head off and threw it at him.
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that.
So I'm not, okay, this is weird to say this is my favorite scene, but it caught me completely off guard, where he woke up like on the beach in like that hut thing, or I guess it was a house. I'm going to say it was a house. To the decapitated woman beside him, and then the entire house exploding with police, like coming into it. Like, oh my God. Like, it was just one of those moments where I didn't expect, like, he wakes up and I'm sitting there watching it and I'm like, oh, there's a decapitated head. And then just the entire thing explodes with police. And I'm like, what kind of sting operation is this? Guy running in, taking pictures and everything. Also, my final note on this, amazing facial hair from the one guy with like, it was a mustache and like a sideburns.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think someone's giving you a run for your money, David.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, mine's not nearly that aerodynamic.
It was like glutton chops.
I don't know. Like, it was like, but they were like weirdly on his face, but connected to it. I'm like, I can't describe, like, you have to see it. So there, I'm through with my bit of this. So thank you.
So as we kind of finalize this, and before we move on to our next little segment we're going to try to do here, would anybody recommend this film? If so, why? If not, why? And Dr. Z, let's start off with you. What do you think? And actually, I want to ask you before we start, have you ever seen this before? Did you watch this in any of your research? Has this come up at all?
I did. I watched this and read the book it was based on as part of my research for the Exhumed special. I would say it's worth watching if you're a fan of Craven, just to like make sure you're covering his whole sort of body of work. Also, I would recommend people watch it of what not to do and how to portray Haitians, Vodou, and women. Yeah. And that's my final thought.
Very true. Justin, what do you think?
I wasted $4 of Ellie's money to rent this. So.
Hey, it's no Meg. I'm sorry. We watched the Meg.
I like the Meg.
There you go. And also, this is based on a book. I have no interest in this book. I guess our trilogy of movies now is stuff based on books that no one knows is based on a book. Because I did not know this was based on a book till it said based on a book. And I'm like, do what now?
Based on a book,
true story. I wish it had based on true events at the beginning. I would, if this had been made in like the late 90s, early 2000s, it would have had a huge thing saying based on true events pop up, or probably inspired by true events, roughly, maybe.
It's more accurate, I think. David, would you recommend this film to anyone?
I would say probably don't spend money on it, but if it's streaming anywhere for free, it's worth a look. If you don't have anything better to watch. And I agree with Dr. Zarka. I think that it would be so much better to be remade by people who really put the culture and the religion first. But I don't know if you could tell this particular story that way either, because this really relies heavily on a lot of pop culture and supernatural elements that just aren't there in the religion itself. So I don't know. It's kind of a 50-50 on that, but I thought this was a fun watch for sure.
And I guess I'll chime in lastly here. I would recommend it. I loved this movie as a kid. I still enjoyed it when I watched it yesterday. It's a little dry in parts, mostly because my attention span's a lot shorter than it used to be. If you like Wes Craven, you have to watch this. This is a must, and I'm a big Wes Craven fan. I love 80s horror, so this also falls in. But I also agree with what all three of you guys said. There's definitely some issues with this film that could be updated or completely forgotten altogether. But it's worth – I'd pay $4. I wouldn't pay it again to watch it, but I'm not upset that I paid it. Let's put it that way. 3.5 stars.
Wait, comparison, how? What would you give the Meg?
zero stars.
All right, okay, so that's the highest we can go. Zero's the highest. Got it.
Big stars. Bigger
stars. Bigger stars. Oh, actually, bigger. David, should anything been bigger in this movie? Or are you satisfied with the size?
The snakes?
Oh, snakes, boy. The head explosion when he throws it? That could have been bigger.
Perfect.
So now for the second half, Dr. Z, we want to kind of poke your brain a little bit about zombies. We want to know more about a little bit about the history, about some yeah. stories maybe that you may have. And I'm going to kick mm-hmm. it off. I gotta ask this question. It's been bugging me since we started. I did a little research, as I said, very little. And I read that in real life, Dr. Davis.
Davis.
Wade mm-hmm. Davis, there it is. He wrote down what the ingredients were. And it was something like a yeah. sea worm that stings, some sort of poisonous toad, a poisonous frog, a puffer fish, mm-hmm. and there was one other ingredient I can't remember. How accurate is that? Do you know anything about all this, all the ingredients that were listed?
I do.
Yes.
From what I understand, that when he brought back the reported samples, they did not have all of the ingredients he said they did. So you can interpret that in a couple different ways, right? That could be either these Haitian people who gave them the powders, basically were just like what happens in the Serpent and the Rainbow movie, right? It's like, I'm not going to give you the real thing. Why would I do that? So, or that he just lied. Mm. Those are the kind of the two conclusions you can reach. But the Vodou and Voodoo practitioners I talked to said that there is something that exists and that they will not share the recipe for it, mostly just for the safety of other people. And some people argue that yes, there are these toxic chemicals that can put people in this state where they appear dead but are not, and then they could wake up in some way. But you also could talk to practitioners of Vodou and Voodoo who would say that's only part of the equation, that there is a spiritual element. So without both things, you couldn't be zombified. So in terms of the actual ingredients, I don't know, and I don't think I should know. I think that there are certain people that should have that knowledge who have earned the right in those cultures, and I'm not one of them.
That makes sense. I actually, in my research, might have discovered what one of those ingredients was. And of course, I didn't write it down, because why would I do that? But there is a particular flower that used to grow in East Africa. And Dr. Davis theorized that perhaps that some of the slaves from the early days brought mm-hmm. this plant over yeah. with them. And apparently this plant has the ability to, I guess, essentially kill people, but they wake up from it. That's the best way to describe it. Like by all appearance, this person's dead. They have no pulse. They have no heartbeat. I'm sure if you hooked them up with some sort of equipment, they probably would, but just mm-hmm. by the human touch. And what I was reading that yeah. this may be the final element to this. And that's actually where the name that they actually came up with a drug in the film, tetrodotoxin, I believe it was called. It's based yeah. on that flower.
Tetrodotoxin,
that's yeah. right.
No, I mean, I don't know about that particular flower, but in terms of some of the captured and enslaved Africans who came from Africa and were brought to Haiti, Haiti was the largest slave center trade port, basically, in the transatlantic slave trade. So there were a very large number of slaves who were brought through there. And I do know that there are some of those captured people did absolutely bring some seeds and like beans and things to grow the food that they knew how to grow. So that tracks. That
he actually found the flowers. He found a whole field full of them over there in Haiti. So for him, that tied this all together. And this is, I'll have to dig up the source and I'll throw it in the show notes so that everybody mm-hmm. can check this out on their own. But it all seemed to tie together, at least, you know, in this telling of the story. And that's the way a lot of these stories work. There's all these loose ends are conveniently tied up. But I just was fascinated by this list of ingredients, because if you look at each one individually, there's definitely some sort of effect that would have mm-hmm. on a person. So you start mixing all this together, and I'm not a doctor by any means, but it just kind of boggles the mind what all those poisons that would kill you alone would do mixed together, if that's mm-hmm. how it works.
I mean, I do think that's kind of part of where this fear is coming from, right? It's this idea that people in positions of power because for me, I don't think it's impossible to talk about zombies without talking about mm-hmm. slavery, because they do result directly from West African diasporic spiritual practices, and Haiti became a breeding ground for all of that, and we have voodoo because of it. But I think that that's part of it, is people in positions of power who were largely white Europeans, especially at the time when this idea of the zombie was really emerging, were afraid that the people that they were trying to put down, the slaves, would have more knowledge about something other than themselves, right? That it's this idea that they're, it's all about, I think zombies in particular, Haitian vodou and voodoo zombies, are about a lack of control, right? So it's that you, even in death, you're not in control of your own soul. So I think that that tracks through all zombie narratives.
Would we even have the knowledge and the culture of this religion if they hadn't had the biggest slave uprising and you know, casting away the, was it French colonists, I believe?
Yep.
If they hadn't driven the French out, like, we might be talking about some kind of more Catholic blend, would you say?
I think that the religion of Vodou would have existed one way or another, just without the revolution or not. But I do think that the demonization of Vodou and the portrayal of zombies originally in early Hollywood films and in travelogues brought back from both U.S. military personnel and journalists, a lot of people, including myself, would argue that those accounts specifically demonized Vodou and Haitians because it was the site of the first successful slave revolt, really. So I think there's a lot of things going on with zombies. And it's one of the reasons why I love talking about them, because it's such a complex issue. And don't get me wrong, like, there are undead corpses all over the world in different kinds of folklore. But the zombie in particular is definitely a result of slavery.
That actually brings me to a question that I also wanted to ask. Mm-hmm. Where else can we find the traditional sense of the zombie? David and I were talking briefly before we jumped on here. We were talking about the Mississippi Delta, obviously, you know, the Caribbean islands, West Africa. I accidentally said East Africa earlier, but I meant West Africa. Is there any other places where this kind of thing exists? We were actually wondering about maybe Native American legends.
Yeah. How are you defining zombie? Do you mean like someone who's technically dead, but their soul has been stolen and can be controlled, or
sure,
like reanimated corpses in general?
Well, let's start with reanimated corpses, because that's where the bread and butter is. But I'm interested in both, actually.
Yeah. So reanimated corpses appear anywhere where people bury their dead, from my knowledge.
Makes sense.
So there's the Chinese Jiangshi, which is like a hopping vampire undead. There's the Nordic Draugr, which is an ancient reanimated corpse from that particular. I mean, they're just everywhere. So I think that the idea of undead in some way or another appear because inherently we're afraid of what happens after death. And the undead force us to face that in a very corporeal way. In terms of zombies as people who have had their souls stolen and are being controlled by someone else, I think a lot of other cultures might consider, or religions consider, that to be more like possession, or soul stealing is something that is very prevalent in West African spiritual practices. So definitely it's there, as you mentioned. I don't know enough about indigenous spiritual beliefs to say whether or not that they have something akin to zombie.
I got a quick question, just for kind of maybe stupid clerical reasons here. Because we mentioned Draugr, which is, of course, from Norse mythology and everything. Mm-hmm. Like Frankenstein's monster and vampires technically count as undead in the sense of there are something that was living that is now dead? Would those kind of technically be part of the undead category then?
Oh, vampires 100% are part of the undead. So for me, the undead is any tangible, corporeal human body that was declared legally dead and is now reanimated. So vampires, mummies, draugrs, zombies can all fit into that. I will actually die on the hill that Frankenstein's creature is not undead. Because I think that since he was created through a mixture of both human and animal parts, that had not existed in a singular body. I don't think he was alive before Frankenstein created him.
But then you get into the, well, what is he at that point? I guess that's more philosophical, but
No, I'm just laughing because I'm literally teaching a post-humanism class right now and we're talking about Frankenstein's creature.
Well, I just wanted to point those out because I know that you have done videos on all those, which are very interesting, and that's why I wanted to give a chance to kind of bring them up on here to discuss real quick.
Well, thank you. No, I appreciate that. And we certainly have plans to do more undead episodes of Monstrum. Just undead's really what got me into monsters in the first place, and I wrote my dissertation about them, and they're very near and dear to my heart in so many ways. So the more undead episodes I can have, the better.
So two more things. One, the cool thing about the Draugr that I never knew until I watched your video was the whole having to take out a wall to take the body out of a house.
Yeah.
I did not know that. If you want to explain real quick, because you'll do a better job than I will, Dr. Z, of explaining what that is, I guess.
Yeah. So the corpse store in Nordic mythology or legend or folklore, I should say, was this idea that the dead, if they were reanimated like a Draugr, that they could find their way back home. And people did not want that to happen. It was like, you were dead. They want you to stay in your grave. And if, God forbid, you know, you do pop up again, that you don't come and essentially harass the living. Because that's the other big thing about the Draugr, is that they're never nice to people. If that's murdering them or their livestock, or that's just roof riding, which essentially from what I can figure out is just them jumping on the roof making a lot of noise, which is apparently very annoying. So the corpse store was something when a person died, they would actually remove part of the side of the building in which the person died in and carry the corpse out that way and then seal it back up, basically. So the idea being that if the corpse did return, it wouldn't be able to get inside the house because the door that it used to exit was no longer there.
Not my final thing for this whole episode, but my other one I wanted to point out is I haven't watched this one, but you did one on the Wendigo. That doesn't...
Yes, the Wendigo.
I've known some mythology, aren't they supposed to be dead that are still alive, but only eat human flesh? Or is that just something I'm completely barking up the wrong tree?
You're not completely off because I think it's been misrepresented a lot. So my understanding of the Wendigo is not a dead human. Who's somehow reanimated and moving around. There's a couple different ways you can become a Wendigo, according to different indigenous lore, but my understanding is you basically transform into something completely different that's no longer human. So dead or undead doesn't really apply, but I think that I'm not surprised to hear that you think that the Wendigo is undead simply because they are flesh eaters. Mm-hmm. That's one of their defining characteristics is we have taken that, like the European or ideas, right, about vampires and werewolves and also zombies, and sort of put it onto this other flesh eating body and loop them all together when we don't necessarily should be.
So
it's like our own tetrodotoxin in our minds, in our culture,
and everything's just kind of mixed together. So like the Wendigo in particular was only written down because, of course, all of the indigenous stories were told orally when basically European people came and started writing down the Wendigo legends. They got it to try to make, and this could be both ways, right? So it's like to try to make a connection with these people and understand their culture. They're like, oh, it kind of reminds us of the werewolf. But then you start adding maybe werewolf characteristics to it, and it, the whole thing kind of gets muddled. But you're right, this is what we do in history. History creates monsters.
And the Wendigo, that has strong ties to starvation and cannibalism, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I read the
worst of humanity.
Yeah. I think the Wendigo was really a reminder for people that when it's cold and there's not a lot of food, it's about cooperation, right? It's kind of promoting the idea that you should share your resources with others, because if you don't, they might eat you and then become a Wendigo and kill a bunch more people.
Well, it's almost like a cautionary tale in that way.
Exactly.
You can extend that to zombieism in a way. I'm going to use my imagination here a bit, but dead human bodies are something that the living should avoid for health reasons. You know, obviously we've known this for thousands of years. That's why we've kind of adapted some of the natural reactions we have to dead bodies. So I guess, is it a cautionary tale where you should just stay away from the dead? They could come back and get you. They could come back and I'm speaking more of the flesh eating style of zombies, less than the Haitian zombies. But do you think there's anything there that it could be something developed as a cautionary story, or is that me just making things up?
No, I don't think you're that far off. I think especially certain kinds of zombies in certain stories are cautionary to stay away from dead bodies, stay away from graveyards, mm-hmm. stay away from a whole assortment of things. But I think it's important to point out that some cultures don't feel that way, right? So for one example, right, would be Dia de los mm-hmm. Muertos is a celebration of the dead, and you want to go and basically try to have a meal with them. So I think it really depends on the culture that's looking at the zombie. But I do think, we don't like the idea of dead bodies. I think, again, because they remind us too much of ourselves and our inevitable, the inevitable fact that we will all die.
I think there is such a rich history of death and dead bodies and cultures too. And I'm reminded of Zoroastrianism, where they have the Towers of Silence, because when someone dies, their corpse has in their belief, the ability to contaminate things around it with the negative spirit, for lack of a better term, called druge, and that can taint the living and not only allow in kind of like evil forces or Ahriman, you know, the opposer to Ahura Mazda, the god, the main god that they worshipped. Not only does it allow that stuff in, but it also taints a person, makes them very unclean. So what they would do with mm-hmm. the bodies would take them up into big towers that they were called Towers of Silence, and they would leave them out for the carrion to pick at and clean. And so, like, as far back as Zoroastrianism, you know, we have all these different rituals and things that we mm-hmm. do to avoid dead bodies, or to, you know, we place what we think is going on onto the dead bodies, the corpses, and that's how we, I mean, that's just one culture. There's so many different kinds.
That's a good point. I think that just emphasizes this fact, right? That essentially monsters and the undead are about stories, right? I think that they're mm-hmm. both cautionary but educational. So for me, it doesn't seem that far off that, yeah, there was this practical need to remove the corpse from where people were living and eating and trying to go about their lives. So coming up with this mythology or these beliefs doesn't seem like that much of a stretch to me.
Now, I know...
I like the practical part, yeah.
Now, I know all our listeners are just screaming at us right now. They want us to talk about these flesh-eating zombies. When did these guys come into the picture? Where did they come from? Can you trace any of this back? Yeah. Is there a history to mm-hmm. any of this stuff?
There's a history to everything. Yeah. but the short answer would be, although there are different, you know, mythologies and cultures like we've been talking about that have this idea of some kind of flesh-eating undead, tying zombie as a reanimated corpse to flesh eating actually was Night of the Living Dead, George Romero.
I kind of thought that.
Yep. He was the first one to show them on screen and to really, I like to call Romero the Bram Stoker of zombies, right? It's like there were all these different threads of mythology that he sort of pulled together into one creature, but that it was so well done that we've adopted it as the primary example for zombies.
And prior to that, like movies like White Zombie, and I'm trying to think of some mm-hmm. others, they were...
White Zombie, I Walked with a Zombie. Yeah.
I Am Legend.
They were just the dead-eyed zombies that just kind of sat around kind of situation. I haven't seen
they were they were Haitian zombies, essentially, right? I mean, a distortion of that, but they were believed to be people whose souls had been stolen. Then you go through, then of course it's, you know, maybe there was a couple weird ones in the 50s about like aliens controlling humans and making them zombies, but Romero was the first one to show on screen this idea of just random corpses popping up for no discernible reason who were then going to come and eat you.
And it was terrifying.
And for that, I thank him.
Yeah, it was such the concept, because there's a never ending stream of, mm-hmm. of villains in this particular situation. And that makes it terrifying. You know,
absolutely.
For every person that your opponent kills, you have one more enemy. So these just they continue building. It's just a terrifying concept. And then you look at things like I haven't seen the film, but I saw the trailer, World War Z, where they're piled up on top of each other like ants. Like, you just think about that. Like, what are you think about what living humans are capable of? And then you go beyond that and think, well, what if they're dead and moving around? What could they do?
That's something I actually talk about in both the documentary Exhumed, A History of Zombies, and in the final YouTube video that's coming out on October 27th, is this idea that I think we see so many more zombies on screen, like in World War Z, or even in The Walking Dead, right? Because there are simply more people on Earth. Like, we're dealing with overpopulation, and I think that that's being reflected very strongly in zombie films, where even in Night of the Living Dead, you had like maybe 50 zombies at one time, then it was like a couple hundred, couple thousand, and now it's millions. And that jump, I think, really has to do with our fear both of the expanding world and the knowledge that we have, and also the sheer volume of humans on that are, you know, threatening our limited resources.
And there's also a message there that kind of parallels what we're going through with this pandemic, you know, trust in other people, just overall health and taking care of yourself and
toilet paper,
shotguns.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I don't know if you guys have seen, but there's a lot of psychologists and some other scientists have been doing studies and consistently are showing that people who watch a lot of horror movies or read a lot of horror were showing better preparedness, both physically and mentally, for the pandemic.
Oh, I'm ready to go. And I've been watching horror since I was born. I'm all set.
You and me both, yeah.
I would love a book on all the different kind of turns to where folklore has taken a point of having the culture and the folklore associated with it, and then someone comes along and, like you were saying, Bram Stoker writes something, or George Romero comes along, and then there's that boom, now all of a sudden that's everybody's concept of it, you know, like now vampirism kind of ties back to what Stoker wrote about. Now zombies, people think of Romero's, even probably we were talking about the Wendigo, and I think if I'm trying to think of the guy who wrote that poem, Algernon Blackman, maybe?
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Like, even stuff like that, it seems like there is a certain point where we get a culmination of culture and folklore, and then someone takes it and synthesizes it into one thing, and then from then on, everybody's kind of got that concept in their head. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and to be honest, I think I'm guilty of doing that, and probably all four of us are, that, you know, we hear things, well, probably not Dr. Z, I'm sure she actually researches, but our stuff out there, like, well, you know, this one person said it had horns, so now it has, you know, in this account it has horns, and you get three of those, and suddenly this thing has horns, and it was just a made up or a misremembered fact, or not.
That's what happened with the Wendigo, is that people think that it has stag horns because of one movie, when there's no evidence in any of at least the research I did that existed.
Algernon,
I learned that from your show, actually.
Algernon Blackwood, ring a bell?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Blackwood. Yeah, Blackwood. That's
about the feet on fire running so fast, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, actually, speaking of running so fast, I've got something for the entire table real quick. Fast-moving zombies, I mean, human-speed-moving zombies or slow, sluggish zombies. I go with, I prefer the slow, sluggish ones because I feel it's 10 times more terrifying. And the running ones, just I'm like, I don't get it. You know what? I'm going to go with our guest next. Dr. Z, which do you prefer?
Ooh, prefer? I don't think I prefer one more than the other. I think personally, the fast-moving ones, which I call rage zombies, subset of the pandemic zombie, I think that they are the scariest to me. And I think part of the reason is because there's this idea that it's so inevitable, that they're too strong, too fast, there's too many, that maybe you can outrun the slower moving ones, but those fast ones are coming at you. And that, there's something about that and the idea that the body isn't decaying, or at least not quickly enough, that I find additionally eerie.
Derek and David, what about you two?
Well, I'd prefer not to encounter any zombies, if I'm honest, but I guess I would rather the slow ones. I feel like I'd have a better chance at survival. But there's a small part of me that's like, man, it'd be really exciting to have all these fast zombies running around. Like, for about 10 minutes, and I'd be like, okay, guys, you got to stop. Just give me a break. Just 10 seconds.
Cramp.
No, I think of Zombieland, right? One of the primary rules is like cardio. You know, so you can actually
I'm with Dr. Zarka. If you put a slow moving zombie, even a horde of them, there's a chance you can get away or like finagle your way out of the situation. The World War Z zombies, that's terrifying. Like, and even when you like shoot them or chop them up or whatever, they're still coming and no, thank you.
You know, while we're on the subject of zombies, weirdly enough, what is everyone's favorite zombie film? I'm just kind of curious. I've been trying to think of mine this whole time, and I'll start. I got to say, it's probably 28 Days Later would probably solid be choice. Mine. I might change that as I come up with other ones that I've watched, but that's one of the big ones. Dr. Z, what's one that sticks out to you the most?
Oh, good. I'm glad you're asking me that question instead of favorite, because I don't think I have a favorite. I group them so differently now. I think my favorite zombie movie I've seen in the last 10 years would be Train to Busan, hands down.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
You need to watch it. Everyone listening should watch Train to Busan. It's fantastic. It's a South Korean zombie film that's basically set on a moving train, and it has all of the elements that I love about a good horror movie, that, you know, the living or the real threat, but there's enough scares and zombie creepiness that it's still such a fun watch. But I think so smart, beautiful cinematography, highly recommend.
There's actually a werewolf film with the same premise. It's some sort of bullet train through Europe, and there's a werewolf on board. Yeah.
Ooh, I'll have to check that out.
Silver bullet train.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's our show for the evening. Yeah, I don't know what that one was called. I saw it on like Hulu or something. I haven't watched it yet, but I saw the trailer.
I think mine would probably be, and this is probably a cop out, but I always enjoy Shaun of the Dead.
Oh, good.
Yes.
I'm going to cop out with David here and go with Shaun of the Dead as well. Though, I'll point this out. Zombies are not like my top of the list of like scary movie stuff. I thought this, like I said, the Serpent Rainbow is interesting because it wasn't even the right type of zombie for what it was supposed to be, but it was something a little bit different. And I know I'm going to hit Dr. Z with this one. I actually remember as a kid too, watching Scooby-Doo and Zombie Island. And that was honestly the first one I can think of that I watched as a kid. And cause you mentioned it on your episode.
Yeah. Because I honestly can't remember which one I saw first, Night of the Living Dead or Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island. But that movie, maybe that's where I am today, because that movie left such an impression on me. Because weren't they also like cat people who were making zombies?
Yeah, there was some weird voodoo. I haven't seen in years, but I did pull up like a brief summary just because I was like, I'm going to take a look and it's like said cat people. I'm like, yeah, this is definitely what I'm remembering.
This is it. This is a real deep dive into my personal history, but the thing that absolutely scared me more than that was the freaking Archie's Weird Mysteries episode with the potatoes that turn people into basically zombies.
What?
They're like creepy space potatoes, and they grow out their little like spud arms and latch onto you and make you like a puppet. And I still can't look at a sprouting potato to this day without being completely freaked out.
Wow.
So, fun facts.
Interesting. Speaking of fun facts, I noticed that all four of us picked foreign films. Is there any, anything? I'm a film guy. You know, I went to film school. So is there anything in that? Is there a lacking in zombie films in the U.S.?
Oh, definitely not.
Well, lacking in quality. Yeah. Quality.
You want me to honestly answer that? Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, this is an honest
but
podcast.
But like I said, I'm not a super big zombie. Like, the reason I like Shaun of the Dead is because it's mocking that stuff. I mean, like I said, zombies are okay, but I'm not like somebody that's like, ooh, zombie film. So I know I'm probably the odd man out in this situation.
Yeah.
I don't seek zombie films out.
I like them.
World War Z would be an American zombie film, right? And yeah. Zombieland. Sure. But
darn, I forgot about Zombieland. Like, Zombieland was, once again, I like the humor of it, of the situation more so than, like, I don't know. I just don't, I don't know.
With Zombieland, I look at it as this is a great film, but it's not a great zombie film. Does that make any sense?
Yes, I would.
Yeah.
It's a great comedy, but it's not a great zombie. I wouldn't even say zombie comedy.
It is for about half of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love to get a more true to the book World War Z movie.
I still need to read that.
Yeah, you do.
I really do need to read that. I've read his other book, the Devolution, which was phenomenal.
I haven't read that one yet, but I did have a chance to meet Max Brooks and actually talk to him about Launchstrom when it was first starting out, which was amazing. And he's actually really cool and nice. So that's always fun when you meet like famous people and you're like, oh, you're actually like an okay person. So he was great. But the zombie, you need to read World War Z. I think you need to approach, I think the book is good and I think the movie are good, but they're not the same.
Oh, I've already heard that. That's why I want to go at the book, because I feel like I'd enjoy that more. Like I said, his other book was phenomenal, and
Book's great.
Well, on that note, gentlemen, is there anything else we wanted to cover before we cut our guest loose for the evening?
I mean, talking about monsters, we could go all night.
I know. I just saw a pause, and I saw it's an hour. I thought maybe I'd at least mention it.
But why stop now?
No, I appreciate you coming on and talking to us, Dr. Zarka. This has been great.
Thank you so much for having me. I'd love to come back on and chat more monsters or the men.
Yes. Someone on my side.
Retired.
Someone on my side.
We've had a string of pretty terrible movies. We've been doing this for like a year or so, and we did The Man That Killed Hitler and then The Bigfoot, which didn't go over well. The Meg didn't go over well. La Llorona didn't go over well.
Which La Llorona?
The American.
Oh, not the good one. Yeah.
The Curse of La Llorona is absolute trash, but the one on Shudder is good.
We should have watched that one.
I've heard that. Yeah. I've heard that.
Oh.
So.
There is one more thing back to the rainbow, the serpent in the rainbow. So, David, I'm surprised you didn't point out the like people getting like tossed from one side of the room to the other.
My gosh, there was a lot of tossing going on, and that the dude, the main bad guy, he leapt twice at the end, like he just zoom. He's like Barracuda through the air at the Bill Pullman. I did make a note of that actually.
He's probably 5'3" and just tossing Bill Pullman from one side of the room to the other.
I had to mention that because when we said La Llorona, I remembered. Oh yeah, punting the kid out the door. Gotta mention, was there any brutal tossing around?
My favorite part.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you so much, Dr. Z, for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me.
We had a good time with this. Usually it's just us complaining about movies, but we actually have somebody in here with some information. So it's really a good time.
It's true.
So thank you.
Glad I could help.
All right, gentlemen. Well, this has been yet another Night at the Round Table. I have been Derek Hayes.
I've been David Flora.
And I've been Justin Zinger.
Have a good night.